Hey everyone, welcome to Building Infinite Red, a podcast where the founders of Infinite Red,
Jamin Holmgren,
Ken Miller,
Todd Worth,
share stories and insights into creating and leading a software consultancy on the edge of tomorrow. I'm your host, Chris Martin, and the topic of this episode is all about the lessons learned in charging for software development. Starting with a question from the Infinite Red community, Todd, Ken, and Jamin touch on hourly versus project pricing, the tension between time and value, how software estimating is a lot like weather forecasting, and the many experiments conducted over the years to find the right pricing model for Infinite Red. Be sure to check out this episode's show notes, links, and a full transcript at building.infinite.red/9. Let's get into it.
We received a question from the community, community.infinite.red. It's a Slack community that we have. Trent asks, "Hey, Jamin, I'm enjoying the podcast. Will you guys be covering hourly pricing versus project pricing? It's a question we're dealing with right now. Which do you guys prefer, and what are some lessons learned to bring you to that choice?" I think this is a really great question. Todd, do you want to talk about what we're doing right now, and then we can go into maybe what we've done in the past and why we brought us to that choice?
Sounds good. Yeah, that's a great question, and it's actually a really tough one to deal with. So what we do now is we do weekly pricing. We charge per person week, and we call it person week as opposed to a week of work, because it could actually be two people working maybe half a week each, and that would be one person week. Because we're doing person weeks, we have a point system. So 100 points equals a person week. We don't track time. We used to, and we can talk about that. We used to bill hourly. We don't track time. We don't actually know how long things take. It's just we estimate our tasks and in points. And if we've reached 100 or more per person week and we charge per person week, then we're accomplishing our goal.
There's a bit of a tension between time and value. And this has been something that we've dealt with. I mean, I've dealt with since I started my first consultancy. You know, value, of course, value-based pricing is kind of a holy grail of pricing for consultancies. And we've heard this for a long time that you should charge for the value, not just the time that it takes. So an example of this would be fixed bid pricing, where you're essentially betting on, delivering the software in a reasonable amount of time, but you're getting paid on the value to the client. The problem is that our costs are not based on value. So we're not necessarily paying our people based on the fixed bid, a percentage of the fixed bid or something like that. There are industries that do that, but ours is not one of them. So we're paying people salary, and our costs are over time. And so if something takes a very long time, then our profitability and the ability of the company to remain financially solvent is threatened. Conversely, you have, of course, hourly, and we've done that in the past. And the nice thing about hourly is that it corresponds very tightly with the amount of time that it takes to do. But the problem is that every hour is not equal. You have hours that are, maybe really, really valuable. You've automated something, and in a lot of cases, you're actually delivering more value than the client is paying for, quite a bit more. And then there are others where maybe the person's getting spun up, or they're hung up on a particular problem, whether it's their fault or not. And that turns into a bit of an issue, because you're billing, hundreds of dollars an hour for something that where the client isn't really getting a lot of value. So I think that's why we ended up where we are in a way.
Yeah, both have issues. When you're doing hourly, it might seem to a client that's more fair, but it's not. It means every time there's a bug or every time there's an issue, we basically are nickel and diming them, and they don't necessarily like that. We have to spin up someone, like Jamin said, where in our value system that we use now, they don't see any of that. We fix the bugs because it's part of the value of that particular feature. It does mean, though, sometimes that we can produce a feature faster than the hourly would have been, and so they get charged, I guess, more for that.
There's a couple of different ways that hourly works out sometimes, though. There's certainly the very literal, like you sit there and you run a clock like the way a lawyer would, right? So you actually have a little timer that shows exactly what you're doing. When I worked for like a large sort of corporate consulting company, big five style, back in the 90s, I remember like my first week, I was filling out my time card and I filled in the like insane hours that I worked, because that's the kind of work that you do. And my project manager comes over to me. He's like, no, this is not what you do. And he took my time card and he filled in 8888888.
That's ridiculous, but
right. So right. that's how the big five work often.
So it's completely fake in that situation.
It's completely fake, yeah. Right? And it's basically pretty close to what we do now, which is that weekly billing, right? Where it's like an right. hour is just a way of measuring a week. Yeah. If you have, you know, to answer the question directly, right? You know, do we prefer hourly or project-based? We prefer hourly.
Yeah.
We hourly leads to less problems in the long term, because the trouble with the fixed bid, although it seems like it's appealing, if you think you can be really efficient, like it's appealing from your point of view, if you think you can be really efficient, it's appealing from their point of view, if they think you can't. But that's exactly it right there. It creates this right. adversarial relationship. Todd?
Yeah, clients but many clients think they would love a fixed bid. And in truth, they will hate a fixed bid. Ken's right. Fixed bids create an adversarial situation. Even if both sides are extremely, they're at the table in good faith and they're trying to do the right thing and do their part and stuff, it still means that the client is trying to get as many hours as possible out of you for the same price, and us would be trying to get as few hours as possible. And like I said, even if you're both being very nice and very ethical in the way you're billing, that always creeps in. It also means that you have to lawyer every change. You'll have companies that have changed order systems that are pretty complex. Clients hate that. When I talk to especially startups, one of the things I say is, if the project we're working on at the end ends up exactly as you envisioned at the beginning, that's a huge red flag. That means yes. you didn't listen to your beta testers. That means you didn't think at all during the process after you got in your hands what could be better. It means a bunch of different things. So we have a pretty strong process, but it's designed to be flexible. We want it to be flexible. So when we get to the point where we do estimation after a research phase, it's fairly accurate. And I tell people that this estimate is fairly accurate. The likelihood that it will actually produce your project for this estimate is extremely low. Not because we're incompetent. I'm sometimes incompetent, but not because we're incompetent, but because you're going to make a bunch of changes and we welcome that. We don't lawyer that. That's a little bit of difficult. There's a little education involved in getting people to understand that fully.
One of the objections is that, well, there are other companies that do fixed bid and they seem to do just fine. Like they're able to, you know, sustain that and their customers are generally happy and things like that. But I think there's a hidden cost in there that people don't take into account, which we've sort of driven a stake into the ground. We've said, hey, we're not willing to go down this route. And that is that those companies put the burden of hitting those estimates onto their employees. They essentially say, okay, well, we estimated this amount. You're not done yet. So you're going to stay late until it's done. And they push and push and push. And they really, really just drive the screws in on their employees. Maybe not overtly, maybe not directly, but there's a culture and an expectation of being able to hit those estimates that puts a lot of stress on the employees.
Yeah, that doesn't necessarily look like a slave driver. It can look like a rah-rah, sleep when you're dead. work right. hard, play hard. Yeah. That kind of corporate culture. Yeah. There are firms out there that I respect that do fixed bids, and they seem to make it work, and that's fine. But in our experience, someone is paying for that somewhere.
Exactly.
there's another type, fixed bid, which isn't just slave driving your employees into the dirt. It is, you think it's going to cost $100,000 on this project, you bid $800,000. So no matter what, unless you're ridiculously off, you're fine. And the problem comes in with clients want both the lowest possible price and a fixed bid. That just, it's not really possible.
So our system is different. And Todd, I'd like you to actually talk a little bit about why our, you know, because we are giving an estimate with points and we're trying to hit those points. So it may feel like a fixed bid, but do you want to like explain what we're doing differently where it really does change over time as you do a project?
Yeah, so we do spend a decent amount of time doing research, architecture, that kind of stuff before we estimate the points. So we're not just doing a ballpark estimate. We do a ballpark estimate at the beginning, but that's a few hours of our time. But we spend a couple of weeks or whatever doing research, architecture, that kind of stuff. And then at the end of that, we produce an estimate in points. So those are fairly accurate. Obviously, anyone out there who does software development, by the way, everything we're talking about here is for development. Design, on design side, we do fixed bids. And that's a kind of a different discussion. The gentleman who asked this, the question, it was more towards the development side. So that's what we're talking about.
Right.
So our estimates are based on a whole lot more information than a lot of people do. And we do have clients who want an accurate estimate earlier. And we just have to push back because we, in that situation, we have only two options. We either push back against them and try to educate them in the process and help them, you know, do a successful project, or we lie to them. And unfortunately, a lot of companies just lie. They just come up with a number. Yeah. They act like they put some thought into it. They didn't. I worked for a consulting company in the late 90s where the way we estimated was ask the salesperson how much they could afford. That was our miracle estimate.
Right.
Which to me, I hated as an engineer. I just loathed it. So, but I'm digressing a little here, but I don't want to make it out that our estimates are super accurate or the estimating software at all is an accurate thing at all. We know it's not.
One of our sort of colleague companies out there calls them forecasts, which I really like. People understand like a weather forecast is not necessarily going to be accurate. It's like the, based on what we can see right now, this is what we think is going to happen, and everyone understands that. I really like that as a bit of language.
Yeah, I like. Right. We should call it forecasts.
I'm tempted to steal that, but
the other cool thing about a forecast is it's known the further out you are from that day, the less accurate the forecast is, and the closer you get, the more accurate. And that's very true in our situation as well.
That's a great point, Todd, because we will definitely adjust those estimates as we get into things and as we learn more. And I try to, you know, I do a lot of the sales calls now, and one of the things I try to do is set the expectation that over time, the estimates will get more and more accurate as we know more. Same thing with the weather forecast. Like you look at the 10-day and you look at day number 10, and as you get closer and closer, you're going to see a better and better forecast. And it's not uncommon for that to change even quite drastically, because weather systems can get, you know, delayed a little bit or something, and that can impact which day they land. And
unless you live in California, in which case our weather never changes. So
yeah. No, I live in the Pacific Northwest near the Columbia River Gorge, and nobody understands the weather here.
Our weather is hot and sunny. Tomorrow, hot and sunny. The next day, hot and sunny.
What if it's sunny and
then terrifying
hot
thunderstorm?
Yeah,
well, and
then hot and sunny.
Once a year, we have terrifying water from the sky. I live in Las Vegas, Nevada, which is in this very small patch. I'm totally digressing here, but it's a very small patch in the U.S. with the most sunshine, the total U.S. And it's just basically Las Vegas and around the desert area here. I think, I don't know, some ridiculous, like 300 and some days of pure sunshine. But just nice, as I lived in San Francisco for 20 years, and it is the opposite of that. And I enjoy that for a long time, but I enjoy this. Anyways, so one of the things I wanted to bring up is, and we should, I think we should talk about estimates, because
yeah,
estimates are a big part of how you charge, and it is a difficult problem, and we have all sorts of issues that I think would be very interesting for listeners to hear that they're not alone in, and we're still struggling with.
Nobody has the magic bullet on.
Yeah, and
nobody has a magic bullet on that.
It's a soft problem. It's definitely a people problem. It's something I'm actually actively working on all the time. But to finish up what we were saying before, we do find the weekly billing has worked out very well. It does require education. Your clients may instinctively go, okay, well, they're just doing this to make more money because they're going to get it done way faster, and they're going to charge me this extra money, and they're not going to do anything. And that's a perfectly normal human reaction. But one of the ways that we add some sugar to that tea is we say, you know, a bug comes up. Sometimes bugs take 5 minutes. Sometimes bugs take a half a week to fix. That's all included in that estimate. You don't have to worry right. about that. No nickel and diming. When the estimate goes up, say we add person weeks to the overall estimate, and then maybe we add some calendar weeks. By the way, we have typically a minimum team of two. So, and most time people work on one project full time. So if you have a two person team on a project, we're producing two person weeks per week. From that and the number of points we estimate, we can calculate the calendar time as opposed to the person week time. And the calendar time does get extended, and the person weeks do get extended. But it's usually from changes, and we try to be very good about being very transparent and explaining, and the clients should know what all those changes were. They hopefully have approved them, and that's what adds the person weeks and that sort of thing.
There are some times where we will feel like maybe we made a mistake, and it was in such a way that it was maybe, you know, we're not comfortable charging the client more for a particular thing. And in that case, we will, you know, adjust what we're billing for a particular chunk of a project. Mm-hmm. And we'll take on that risk. There's a shared expectation of being reasonable in this. You know, if a client's asking for something, then we're going to bill more. If we make a mistake, then we'll try to rectify that as much as possible. But it does have flexibility built in, and that's important. But then also, like you said, Todd, the bug fixing is built in and things like that. That really helps mitigate mm-hmm. the amount of risk that the client is taking on.
And truthfully, it's much easier for the people doing the actual work, because they don't have to constantly, this 3 hour task is now a 5 hour task. I have to ask permission for those extra 2 hours. And it's just a lot of paperwork and a lot of thought about stuff that has nothing to do with making a great project. And I'd also want to add on what Jamin just said. The way we deal with issues, let's say the value wasn't there, we had some problems, we typically do deal with it on the invoicing side. We tell our people, you know, okay, for whatever reason, we're not going to be charging for these person weeks. But from their perspective, it doesn't matter. They're estimating points. They're working during the week. They're getting at least 100 points per person week. And they just keep on going forward. We'll adjust it on the backside, on the invoicing side, so that our process keeps going and we have accurate data, even if we're in a situation where we made a big mistake or something like that and we're not charging them for, say, a few weeks or whatever.
Yeah, totally. And Ken, would you want to talk about the chronic problem of underestimating? Because I know this is something that's near and dear to your heart.
Yeah, I don't know why. Engineers, I don't know if it's they want to feel like they, you know, they're really fast, or they feel guilty that, you know, or if it's imposter syndrome or whatever it is. But it is a chronic problem that engineers will estimate too optimistically. And so we have sort of structures and practices, and this is not an easy problem to solve, right? But we have sort of structures and practices in place to kind of counteract that, hopefully. Whether it's sort of checklists, like have you considered like these sort of failure cases? Like have you included the bug fixing in the testing time? Is the testing time including every platform that you could possibly use this on, et cetera, yeah. Todd?
Yeah, this is a problem we have not solved. We really try to hire, and I think we have hired really decent ethical people. which is fantastic. And that's the intention. And I very much enjoy working with almost everyone here. Maybe not Ken, but that's okay.
he can't fire me.
I cannot.
It's a perk.
I've tried many times.
It's a perk of the job.
Actually, it's funny because I've been working on this a lot lately. We hire good ethical people, which I very much enjoy, but they tend to feel more guilt and they tend to be a little, you know, they contemplate it and worry about it a little too much, to be honest. And so we do have chronic underbilling. One of the things we do is we ask them for estimates, and we never, ever, up to this point, have ever said, this estimate's too high. You need right. to reduce this estimate, because right. this is the estimate they're giving us, and we're going to, and where they're going to do the work. And it's not fair for us to come and say, okay, you said it's going to take, you know, 100 points. I think it'd take 50 points. And then, of course, when they do it, it takes 100 points. They right. failed only because, in my opinion, it should have been 50. We never do that. We right. never, we never push back on that. So you would think that just human nature, in order to alleviate stress, that they would say, okay, this is going to take 50 points, but I'm going to make 150 points. Just give me less. No one does that, surprisingly. Yeah. That is not the problem we deal with. And it could be just our team. I probably not just our team. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that do that.
I mean, I've seen this everywhere I've ever worked, right? That, people want to feel like a hero. People don't, it's not as much fun to think about all the ways that things go wrong. Depending on your personality, I guess. But yeah, I mean, the ideal way that we're always striving toward is basically the engineer gives us like as accurate and conservative of an estimate as possible. And then in terms of how we present to the client, if we feel we need to make an economic adjustment in order to get the sale, for example, then we will do that on our end. We don't want it baked into the estimate.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Todd actually ran an experiment with our own engineers at one point. He took a screen, I think it was a login screen of a project we'd actually already done.
Yes.
And sent it to several engineers and asked what their estimate was. And you want to talk about that, Todd?
Yeah, I've done a few of these to try to kind of understand this problem. But in that case, it wasn't clear what kind of project it was, whether it was a mobile app, an iPad app, a website. I did that on purpose. I also didn't give them any requirements other than I gave them a screenshot, which is not untypical, to get from a client if we didn't do the design, is just get these screenshots. So I wanted to see A, how they approach the estimation process, and B, what their estimates were. So I'll skip to the spoiler part. The lowest one was like 3 hours. This is back when we did hours. We weren't doing points. The highest one was like 46 hours. So the range is 3 hours to 46 hours. Some people, you know, their estimate wasn't accurate for obvious reasons. They got back to me within 5 minutes and didn't ask any questions. And that was more on the junior side, and that's perfectly fine. And that estimating is probably one of the most difficult things that we do. And so it's understandable when people with less experience do it less well. Mm-hmm. But the interesting part is, like, a lot of people didn't even ask what platform it was on. The person who did 46 hours, the highest one, had a huge write-up of all the reasons why it was 46. And when you look at it, you're like, yeah, because it seemed very simple. Like, it's a login screen. It's two text inputs and a button that says login. Yeah. But there's actually a huge amount of stuff. A lot of people assume they were just doing the screen, as opposed to actually making it work, like the whole thing, like making you log into the back end and Facebook integration and all this stuff. But the fascinating part is how different it was and their different approaches.
It should be mentioned, though, just for the record, that the way this exercise was set up was intentionally, on Todd's part, very vague, right? It wasn't like, hey, I need you to do this for a client so that we can get a good estimate, right? It was a very offhand. But the range of responses to that very vague setup was illuminating, because some people are constitutionally incapable of not treating that seriously, right?
Yeah.
And some people are like, whatever, Todd, I got work to do, right? So there's going to be a very broad range there. And the range of real estimates is probably not going to be quite as wide, but still.
Yeah.
Ken has a particular personality, and so does a few other people on our team, where he really didn't like the gotcha part of that question, the vagueness of it. And he felt like I was looking for a real answer and he was set up to fail on the real answer because I didn't give him any information. That wasn't the point of it. I actually didn't care what their answer was as much as the process by which they went around the answer. And I didn't say that on purpose too. And so he was a little bit like, you're setting me up to fail. I don't like this. Go to hell. which was kind of funny, but it's funny from your perspective, but it's actually, it's also illuminating for people with that type of personality. That's the reaction they have to that. And that's a very real thing.
Well, it's also like, if you just ask me a very vague offhand question, I'm going to devote a vague offhand amount of attention to it. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think a lot of other people are going to be that way, too. It's kind of like, oh, OK, like without any further information, why am I going to like spend an hour breaking down this problem for you or however long it takes? Yeah.
I will point out that mine was both quick and accurate.
I hate giving Jamin a compliment, but his actually, I thought Jamin's was probably one of the more accurate, and he did it very fast and it was very thorough.
We brought Jamin on because he's lucky.
That's right. I have a rule. Every quarter, I randomly fire one of our team. And the reason I do this is very simple. I don't want anyone unlucky working on our company. Jeez. That's a joke in case anyone thought it wasn't.
Yeah.
We don't horribly fire people because they're unlucky. But yeah, so that's a very interesting thing on that. But there's other things too. Like another experiment I did was I had people estimate something simple again. And then they gave me the estimate, whatever it was. The numbers don't matter, but let's say they said 10 hours. And this is once again back when we did hours. If they said 10 hours, and I would say, okay, what's the likelihood, you know, are you 100% confident that you can do it in 10 hours or under? Are you 90% confident, 80% confident? And then I would ask them, okay, how about 11 hours? How about 12 hours? How about 13 hours? And what I found is the first estimate they gave me, almost no one was confident they could do it in that time, which was fascinating.
It'd be something like 60% or something. And then you would have to go quite a ways up before they were, you know, 90, 95% confident.
Correct. So I'm not sure exactly what to make of that, except for that's a phenomenon.
I did ask some of our employees that were doing an estimate to include a confidence factor. And that estimation is not done yet. It should be in the next week or two, and it'll be interesting to go through that and see where they landed.
Yeah,
there are that would be interesting. Yeah, and there are some other reasons why you might not be confident. You know, maybe there are a bunch of unknowns that we will have to dig into before we'll know for sure. And there's no amount of hours that would satisfy that necessarily. But I think that that's something that you should give a number. It's not, again, we're not doing hours, but doing the point system. You should have your estimate units, of course, for each task, but then also include a confidence factor. And that might be, you know, a percentage or something that you're confident. I think that's an aspect that maybe will be helpful going forward.
To be clear, that's a hypothesis. Jamin has this point. We haven't tested that. So take that as an idea.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Another thing I asked them was, it's very fascinating. Same kind of line of questioning on giving us a very simple thing to estimate. And then I asked them, does that include tests? Does that include QA? Does that include bug fixes? Does that include any production issues when it goes out to the real world? All over the map, whether or not they included, very few people said it included all of that. So when you asked them, how long will this take? And they didn't take that question as, how much time will you spend to have this completely done and you never touch it again? Very few people took it that way. They more took it as, I could get it, you know, done and in the app, and then later we would debug it or test it or make changes or whatever, but that's not included in my estimate. So that was a fascinating result also. Now, I don't have any recommendations for any of this, other than it's very interesting to see how people's minds work and how different people's minds work differently when they're given the task to estimate how long something will take.
There's a couple of ways that we can mitigate that. Ken mentioned earlier checklists. I think those are probably underutilized. That's something that we should use more. So when you're looking at a screen, you'd have a checklist of things, and maybe some of them don't apply and you just mark them off. But some of them are definitely...
Yeah, and there's something else that we're trying, which I've never really heard of anyone else doing. I've never encountered it before. We're trying to keep a database of past features.
Yeah.
So that instead of like sitting and de novo every time, sort of like thinking through step by step every single feature, you say, does this feature feel more like this one or that one? Right. And then you just take the number that we actually empirically determined previously.
Yeah, it gives you kind of an anchor point, and then you can determine if it's maybe more or less than that.
The jury's out on whether this can work as a system or not. But
exactly.
What does de novo mean, Ken?
From the beginning, like from new.
So you replaced from new, which is two syllables, with a three-syllable word, de novo. Okay, just making sure. I understand.
It has further implications, but whatever, Todd. Feel free to make fun of my vocabulary as much as you like.
I wouldn't make fun of your vocabulary, but the word vocabulary isn't in my vocabulary, so...
Obviously,
it's a vicious circle.
So I think it's good maybe for us to go back a couple of years when we merged. We try to be a little bit unconventional in our thinking. We try not to bring a lot of preconceived notions into what we're doing here and think things through de novo. Start from the beginning. Start from you like how I did that. Start from first principles and kind of. Look at it in a way that, okay, can we innovate on this? Can we look at it and come up with something new? And we did, actually. And I don't actually remember whose idea this was. Maybe one of you does. But we had the idea, we're gonna bill hourly. And this is what our initial thought was. We're going to bill hourly. And then let's have like a base salary for all of our developers and designers. But then pay them per... our build that they personally build. And it was an interesting experiment. I think we ran it for probably a year, maybe it was 2 years, something like that. With varying success, and we learned a ton of things that you wouldn't when you just start out as salary employees. I will point out that we are now on salary, but we should talk a little bit about that experiment and what we learned there.
Yeah, that was... We had specific goals and we have tons of good intentions for those goals. And like all good intentions, we fell on our face. But that would be a very interesting podcast in itself. The lessons, what we did, what we went through, what we changed to, and the lessons we learned during the process.
I think to just kind of give it a really quick little thing, since we've teased it here, one of the things that we found was that people are generally not that motivated by money because they could certainly bill more hours and make more money. That was one of the benefits of the system. If you were very productive,
a couple people did.
Yeah, some people did. Yeah, for sure. But not, it was not anywhere near, even a quarter of the people. And so that was good to know. Like, other people, they were just motivated by different things. They're motivated. It's not that they're not motivated, but it just wasn't purely by money. Another thing was that there were some situations that ended up not really being very fair. So, some people would be in projects where bill hours are very easy to come by, and mm-hmm. others where we really, either had to supplement their bill hours or something along those lines. It also didn't really encourage collaboration between people, so there's some silos. So the benefit to the company, obviously, is that if we're having sort of a down month, because it's cyclical, then your costs go down, and the benefit to the employee is if you're having a really busy month, then you're getting paid more. But ultimately, that whole system we went away from and went to the system that we're using today.
Yeah, I can, in my opinion, it was a complete failure.
Yeah.
That being said, it was, I'm pretty sure, originally my idea. And like I said, great intentions, but I think that was one of our biggest failures, to be honest.
We learned a lot. I think that was the big thing. And those lessons will stick with us.
And we changed, and, you know, but it was, I think it was more painful than it should have been.
Yeah.
I forget where I sort of like read, heard, whatever, this advice, but basically when you're starting a new company and you're trying to do something innovative, you should limit what you try to do that's innovative, right? Focus your innovation where it really counts, and then don't try to innovate too much in the rest of your business practices. Right. I think that that's part of what we learned there. Even setting aside all these sort of incentive things, there's a bunch of things just work better when people are on salary, right? Their benefits work better. Like insurance works better.
Vacation time.
Vacation time works better. There's a bunch of things where there's a whole ecosystem of support for how to run a business. And if you try to innovate in how you do that, you cut yourself out of all of those things and make yourself less competitive on the labor market. You make yourself, you spend more time on things you shouldn't be spending time on. And so, you know, I think we've become in some ways a more conventional company in certain aspects so that we can stretch out in the places that we would still want to stretch out.
It's so interesting you said that, Ken, because I literally give people that advice when they're starting out producing an app or a website or whatever it is. It's for the things that don't matter to your particular customers or don't matter to your particular business, stick with tried and true. That's well known. You don't have to worry about that stuff. Put all your innovation and your avant-garde ideas into the things that really differentiate your company from other companies. So it's so funny that you said that in respect to our company, because although we didn't apply it ourselves, it's advice we give.
Well, yeah, it sounded like I'd heard that advice before we did all of this. And the truth is, when you're there, you don't always know which one is the most important.
Well,
right? That's going to happen. But it's worth bearing that in mind, right? To always be asking yourself the question, like, what really makes us different as a company?
Well, yeah.
And if it's not this thing that we're doing and spending a lot of time on, maybe rethink that.
Well, I'll personally admit to hubris. We can do anything, and we'll just apply our big brains to it, and we'll figure it out. But
big brains are not the commodity that's in short supply. It's time. Right, it's time and attention.
I think I'll actually disagree a little bit here. We've actually gotten the feedback that we all agree a little too much here, and so I'll play the part of the devil's advocate here. I think it was well worth trying, and I think that it was actually based on some things that I think in certain cases actually it could work. I think it could actually be something that we. That a particular company could actually make work. It's just that we didn't like some of the side effects of it. Sort of like taking a particular, you know, experimental medication or something. Maybe it works, but the side effects are not worth it. And I think that that's actually where we ended up with that. I wouldn't, like Todd said, I wouldn't necessarily classify it at all as a complete failure. I think there were parts of it that were a failure. And I'm happy with the system we have now. But I'm also very much happy that we tried that.
It was 90% of failure.
It got us to the point we are now.
Well, sure.
What's your confidence level on that, Todd?
I am 90% confident that it was a 90% failure.
Do you guys want to touch on psychology and perception in the role of pricing?
Oh, man.
That's something that I was kind of thinking about as you were talking.
Yeah, actually, I do have some thoughts on that. So one of the questions that comes up is like when you're selling, fixed bid or hourly, what do clients think? You know, is it hard to do? And I've actually found that neither fixed bid nor hourly are particularly hard to sell. Both are well understood. Our current system has been a little bit more, it takes a little more explanation. And so I think that's something we need to continue to work on our messaging on. Most people understand them. Some people have a problem with it. They'll say, you know what, we're not willing to do hourly. That puts too much risk on us. And that's totally cool. It's just, it's not something that, maybe they're not a good fit for us.
Well, I mean, the thing is, whenever you're asking a vendor to assume risk for you, you're paying for it somewhere. right? You know, if they want you to be the insurance, then you're paying them to provide insurance.
Right.
Either that, or they're mismanaged and they're going to go out of business, and then you don't have support. You know, when we switched to weekly, I was concerned that we'd have trouble selling it. It doesn't seem like it's been too big of a deal. For the most part, people still mostly care about the total number.
Correct.
That's right.
And how you get there.
Correct.
They're not usually that concerned with. We've had a few cases where like we've had something recently where like the upstream source of funds was a grant that had rules about how it gets charged, and so there's things that come up around that. So sometimes we'll make exceptions, but we have at least one enterprise client that we still use hourly. But for the most part, this has been pretty popular. We feel like it has the best of both worlds in some respects. It has more predictability than hourly, but it still has built-in flexibility that a fixed bid doesn't.
Our team definitely thinks the weekly is a success. It wasn't that difficult to convert clients from hourly to weekly, and for new clients, they don't seem to mind whatsoever. It's interesting from our team's perspective. Sometimes they could be working more than they used to because they have to fix these bugs or whatever. But because they don't have the stress or the guilt a lot of times of the hourly, they still like it better. So it's kind of counterintuitive in that way.
Yeah, I think there's three vectors or three metrics that you would go off of. How satisfied is the client? Mm-hmm. How satisfied or how stress-free is it for the employees? And mm-hmm. then how much do we as owners like it as a business model? Mm-hmm. And from those metrics, I feel like all three have been a success.
It's definitely been a success. We could do with hourly, but I think the weekly billing has been a huge success. I'm 90% sure that it was 90% a success. As far as the psychology from the client standpoint, we understand one of the things we do is we hire a lot of people who have a lot of experience. Either they ran their own small businesses, they ran teams, that kind of stuff. We have a lot of people who have experience, real world kind of business experience. We're definitely not business consultants per se, but we do work with a lot of startups who need some basic, not basic, but need some of our business consulting. And one of the things that we do is we understand the risk involved. And that's a lot of companies like us don't talk about this at all. For example, from our client's perspective, it's a big purchase. If you're spending $100,000, $200,000, $500,000, that's a large purchase. If you're a startup, that's a risky thing. So we try to really think about their risk. Now, we have our own risks too. We could put five people on a project for a few weeks, incur a huge amount of money, and they could just never pay us. Go out of business, whatever reason. So we have risk as well. So we're not here just to alleviate all their risk and put it on our shoulders, being the risk insurance Ken just mentioned. But we do try to figure out a way to have a nice balance between us helping them with their risk and them helping us with our risk, and just being upfront, like, this is risky. You don't know us. You've had a recommendation. Maybe you liked us during a sales call, so you're choosing us, but you really don't know us. And we're a huge believer in gaining trust over time. So at the beginning, or whatever that word is Ken had, I forgot now already. At the beginning, the risks are much higher. And so we do put a lot of thought into that. Some clients, to be honest, aren't a good fit for our system. And we're very happy to help them find someone who would better fit the system than us. And so we do lose some clients for sure.
Well, one way that some clients have asked us to share an undue amount of risk is when they ask us for hourly with a cap.
Yeah.
That is sort of the worst of both worlds for us. If we finish early, we make less money, but we also take all of the risk of when it goes over. And so we really do refuse essentially to do that. Now, there have been some situations where we've put such a cap on ourselves because of particular circumstances, but we don't work for clients that demand that sort of thing.
Yeah, we have a general rule where we strive not to work for free, which sounds funny, especially if you're in a different kind of business than ours, but it's actually super common for businesses like ours to work a lot for free, for nothing. And it's actually, in my opinion, a rampant problem in our industry. So we really strive not to do that. I think that would probably come to a shock for a lot of people. If you're selling hamburgers, the concept, well, you know, 30% of people walk through today, you're just going to give them the hamburger for free.
Yeah.
That would be shocking to them. But that's kind of like what people like us do. Too much so, in my opinion.
Yep.
Anything else on the psychology from the client standpoint that we could talk to or talk about?
I mean, pricing is a huge topic.
Could you talk about pricing per week or per hour, the psychology? Because I know you've discussed this in the past, Ken, and I'd love for you to tell people.
Yeah. So like one of the things we tried a bunch of different ways of pricing. So one of the things we did before was like we would only bill for extreme, like the instant that we step away from the keyboard, the timer goes off. When we first started, we tried to do this. So we charged like a pretty high hourly rate, but then the actual number of hours burned would be low. Nobody liked that. Like nobody understood that. Like it was much better to bill in the way that people kind of understood about that. When we would bill hourly, like an hourly rate, like we much more likely to get really kind of angry responses sometimes. To people who didn't really have a sense for what software costs, because what people will do is they'll look at the hourly rate and then they'll compare it to how much they make.
Right.
They'll like go, wait a minute, like that's what a lawyer makes or something like that. It's not actually what a lawyer makes, but right.
Yeah.
We would get this very visceral reaction to that. Uh-huh. But by doing it weekly, where we've kind of like smoothed all that out, then they can kind of approach it more like a product that they're buying, right? It's kind of like, well, it's kind of like it comes in this many chunks and okay, that makes sense. So that I think was always one of the benefits of fixed bid for people, right? Fixed bid in sales has always been nice because you can just say, here it is, and that's your price.
Yeah.
Although it's $100,000, they were like, well, my budget's 150. So okay, so I can do that, right? Mm-hmm. And with doing this as weekly, although it's not quite there, right? You know, it is a little bit like the way we're doing it now is a little bit like fixed bid plus an extremely well-oiled change request process, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And that seems to solve kind of both of those problems, where it's like they can look at that and be like, instead of being some unknown number of hours, that weeks are just easy, seem like they're easier to kind of grapple with. And that's exactly what we wanted, right? Was, you know, I don't think we end up charging more particularly, but it does come in these chunks that are easier to grapple with. And they know what size the check is going to be that they're writing next week, yeah, because it's right, going to be a certain cadence. It's not this surprise every time. It just seems to work. It just seems to work better. Go ahead, Todd.
People will pay extra money to remove the surprises happily.
Yes.
I don't think our weekly is more money, but even if it were, they would be happier.
Yeah.
Because they it's so funny. What Ken said is they associate their salary with their hourly, or even if they take their salary and divide it by 40 and divide it by 52 or whatever, and they compare it to ours, they think like, wow, these people are getting paid a massive amount. Of course, they don't see all the other business stuff.
They're not counting the overhead. They're not counting the things that they're not having to pay for. But
I'm not complaining at all, but it's just a fact of our business. We actually have fairly low margins for a business type.
Yeah.
Our team is extremely expensive compared to other businesses, extremely. Not saying we overpay them. But I'm not claiming that. It's just the nature of their jobs.
Yeah. And another aspect of this, and I realize we're going a little long here, but another aspect of this that we could talk about is that with the point system, it's not, you know, 100 points for each person. It's if we had three people working on it, the whole team needs to deliver 300 points. So they work together, mm-hmm, to divide up the work in such a way that, you know, maybe someone's doing 150, the other person's doing 50, but they're, you know, they're doing a lot of client communication or something like that. And allows them to divvy up the work in a way that makes the most sense to them. Where with the hourly bonus structure that we had before, that would actually hurt the person doing most of the communication with the client. And that was a problem.
That's huge. And that was a decision we made. And because we chose that, meaning that individual, we don't track individual contributions. I mean, technically we could probably figure it out based on Trello cards and that kind of stuff, but we don't track individual. It's team oriented. So if there's three people, like James said, 300 points, and we give them the flexibility to figure it out, how to best be the most efficient to do those 300 points, that they can. And I think that's worked out really well. It has some downsides. It's harder to keep metrics on individuals that way.
Yeah, a lot of what we do for that is to simply ask their teammates, you know, how it was to work with them, you know, try to encourage them to be honest about their contributions and things. And it's not a perfect system, but we are able to track individual contributions a little bit better just through the perceptions of their teammates.
I do it more efficiently. I get them all in one room and I say, out of all of you, who's the worst? And then I let them, it's kind of like that movie, that inspirational movie, Hunger Games.
The inspirational movie.
Yeah. So, and it's quite efficient. It takes very little time and you get right to the meat of it. Literally sometimes to the meat of it.
And what they
literally
say is, you are dad, you are.
And I remind them once again, I'm not their father. That's Darth Vader.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Fact.
There's a lot more we could talk about here on this topic. This is probably something we could revisit at a future.
You may have noticed that we like to talk, especially Todd, but yeah, we
my words are all very small, so I need lots of them.
We get very passionate about very dry things sometimes.
Yeah.
There's some things to be said too that on the subject of billing, it's a tough, touchy subject, because although you can say that clients can be difficult in certain ways in regarding to this, it's all, you know, assuming that the client isn't a jerk and they're just trying to, you know, squeeze a rock for as much blood as they can. And let's assume that's the case. And most time that is the case from their perspective.
Wait, you should be clear on what you're saying is the case. Cause that it wasn't, you mean, most of the time, they are not trying to
right.
be
most
jerks.
Right. Most That's of our clients okay, are good. Really great, and they're showing up, and they're being a partner with us, and we're both working towards the goal of making something awesome. So if they are being difficult in a certain way that we may, you know, complain about in the background, they always usually have a reason why. It's either a miscommunication, it's just something that they're understanding on their end.
Yeah, and as you said, like they're presumably getting the software because they need it for some reason, right? And it's a lot of money, and
it's scary.
Important that it be right. Yeah, it is scary.
Yeah, and yeah. And the last thing they want to hear is, I mean, if you're doing a bathroom, you don't want a contractor come over and say it's going to be, you know, from $50 to $50,000,
right?
which may be a true statement, but you don't want to hear that. That's horrible.
Well, one of the ways that we can mitigate that is if someone does have a fixed, like, hard cap budget, which does happen, and we understand when that is, then something else has to be flexible. And usually it's scope. We're not going to compromise on quality. We want to deliver a really quality experience. But scope can be adjusted. And if a client is willing to work with us on scope, we can accommodate a tighter budget and still deliver a quality but narrower scope piece of software.
Yes.
That brings up something very interesting, Jamin. It is a trade-off between low price and low risk. So if we crank up the risk, we can give a quote at a very, you know, the lowest price possible because it may change, but we think we could possibly do it this price. Okay. The easier thing to do is to have a much larger price that reduced risk, but they're almost guaranteed to pay a lot more. Some companies hate the first one. They much rather have a much bigger price that's reliable and low risk. Other companies, especially if they're really lean, they would prefer the first one. And the problem from our perspective is we don't know who is who. And it's hard to get them to tell us, or they may not even know. So when you choose to go down one of those paths, like, do we, you know, give them as lean as possible estimate, but we know it's much more likely to change? Or do we, you know, give them a much larger estimate that reduces their risk? When you're doing that, you're kind of choosing your customer at that point too. It's all very complicated.
As this episode of Building Infinite Red comes to a close, thank you to the Infinite Red community members for asking great questions for us to spend time thinking about and responding to. Do you have a question you would like to ask? Reach out to Todd, Ken, and Jamin on Twitter. You can find their handles on the show notes page, or you can join the podcast channel in the Infinite Red Slack community at community.infinite.red. Would you be willing to share the love for Building Infinite Red? You can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, or give us a shout out on your social channels. Feel free to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and anywhere you listen to podcasts. Thank you so much for listening to Building Infinite Red. We'll talk to you next time.